What's going on, Smart Firefighting World? In today's episode, we're going to sit down with the founder and chairman of the Digit Group, Paul Doherty. Paul is an architect and is an expert into the whole smart building and smart city discussion, and really gives us some good insight into the whole future of the urban city landscape. We're going to look into some really interesting discussions about how we're using data to give us better context for responding to fires and preparing for fires, and most importantly, how can first responders and fire departments get involved with the whole discussion of how we're building smart cities and how we're building smart buildings. We're going to look at some of the challenges between old buildings and old cities, new buildings and new cities, and how some of the context within some of the rapid development has been lost and how it can be regained. And some of the discussion about how all this technology is great, but sometimes your intuition is what you really need to use. And finding that intersection of how we're using technology and data to really apply and bring more value to the first responders as it pertains to smart buildings and smart cities. Take care and hope you enjoy listening. Paul, welcome to the Smart Firefighting Podcast.
Thanks, Ken.
Glad to have you here. So, tell us a little bit about your background and what does the Digit Group do?
Sure. So I'm a licensed architect, not a software architect, a real one, but also a builder, and have built numerous buildings around the world. Also designed them. I'm a big fan of integration, so I'm not separated by the contractor and the designer. I'm actually a design builder. Because of that, we've also been involved with technology. I went through school doing work study up in New York City, and one of the big companies there that was looking for help with design was IBM. So I really understood and got an education from IBM way back in the day when I was designing their trade show booths. You have to start somewhere. And from there, I've always seen the integration of technology and built environment as not this crazy thing. I've always seen buildings as potential computers, where when you can integrate the technology into the physical structure itself, it can help people's quality of life, safety, security in such ways that we're only just beginning to even get our heads around. A lot of that was called smart buildings. And we've then migrated to say, well, it's great to have a smart building, but if you have a dumb neighbor and there's a problem in the neighborhood, that's not a good thing. So we started to take a look at how to integrate data, both from a visualization aspect and also between buildings of sharing data, so that we created neighborhoods, and those neighborhoods became districts, districts became cities. And that's where we discovered this term that IBM gave us actually about 10 years ago called the smart city. Subsequently, we've taken a lot of our skill sets and understanding of how to develop real estate, where we're now a real estate development company that is focused in two big areas. One is the development and design of new urban environments that create urban experiences called smart cities. So these are greenfield cities, cities that don't exist. And then we also have the ability to take a lot of these innovations that are put into smart cities, everything from transportation to healthcare to education, transportation, things like that, that we can take those components and fit them into existing cities based on their needs. There is no one cookie cutter approach to this. It's about understanding that we're kind of like the orchestra leaders that see where there's opportunities to improve the quality of life for people in existing cities and in with these new cities. Most of the new cities we're working on are in China, the Middle East, places like Australia. But the existing city improvements that we're finding in places like the United States and Canada and Europe, where the cities are more established, is really, really interesting, especially when you start getting down to the guts of where we focus. When we develop our existing solutions or our brand new cities, we focus in on safety and security first. One reason why it seems pretty obvious, but it raises the value of why people want to move there to begin with. You know, you're giving up a lot of your social networks, your ability to call up grandma to take care of the kids, that type of thing, by moving your family to a new place. And so my job at the end of the day is to have people fall in love with a piece of dirt. And how do you do that? We have a bunch of different mechanisms to make that happen, including the soft side of things. In other words, these cities, these brand new cities are pop-up cities. They're not, the acceleration of building buildings and infrastructure is one thing, but how do you create that soulfulness of what makes that place special on planet Earth? Most cities have been created over time, usually as trading posts, right? Either like in the interior of the United States, like a place like Chicago, as opposed to the coastal cities, right, where the trade is a little bit, was a little bit more apparent. But it takes time and tradition and celebration of people's families, you know, where you went to school and camaraderie of community that takes time sometimes. What we're looking to do is to accelerate that, where the newer cities, especially ones in the Middle East that are popping up, unfortunately, they took the approach that, well, let's build a lot of buildings and make them look really shiny. And let's do it in a way that you know, is about speed. And what they failed to do on two fronts was they forgot the contextualization that those cities have to have a tie back into the culture, society, again, traditions. What's the mythologies that make that place special? The other thing they did when they built things quickly was in certain cases, they disregarded things like safety, specifically fire code. And that started to really get into our consciousness. My personal background is that I'm a first generation American. My parents immigrated from Ireland. And back in Ireland, my grandfather and subsequently three of my uncles became fire chiefs of an area called County Donegal, right? So when I would go back on, during summer vacations to visit my family, I was always thrilled to go to, the county fire headquarters or to the local fire department in Carndonagh and just be there. I mean, it when it's part of your family, it never leaves you, right? So when I start to see how cities, because of the aggressiveness that they want to take to showcase how smart they are or how cool, a space can be, and then there's a fire event and you realize, oh my goodness, they're vulnerable. Places like Dubai, right? And that really started to get to us saying, what we don't want to do is build another Dubai. We need to start to rethink from the ground up how fire service, how first responders can be helped by designing things properly. For the healthcare side of things, the way that we design our cities is with preventative healthcare already embedded in where we place our buildings. And then how people get to and from either work or from one point to another, where we design wellness into how far you walk until you get to a node of transportation. Mm-hmm. We then go through a second layer that says, all right, once we have that type of wellness factor there's many, many factors that we put into our master plans is how do we build in things that are not built to code? Meaning that codes around the world are the bare minimum. It's the mediocrity level. In other words, if you can get your design to at least hit that level, we'll give you a building permit. And the fire chiefs and everything will sign off on it. But that's the bare minimum. You're designing to mediocrity. It's supposed to be the baseline of you're supposed to design not to code, but from code. So what we do is we take what is required. Like, let's say it's a 1-hour rated wall because it's in a hallway. And you want to make sure that, that hallway is a safe zone for at least an hour. Well, our buildings are 10-hour rated where they don't have to be. Why? Because we can. We have the ability to build through factories now. wall panels, floors, ceilings that through the materials and the way that we can compose them, that it's a cost-effective yet safer environment. We're now taking a look at, how else can we start to exceed code in every place possible without breaking the bank? And what we're finding is sometimes when we find those new processes of how to deliver buildings and infrastructure by listening to the fire community about what are the biggest problems that you fall into that you wish that you could get in front of the designers before the thing's even built. Like, what were you thinking sometimes, right?
Yeah, and Paul, just to kind of expand on that point, a lot of what this podcast is, we're diving into technology and how is technology adopted and really used in the fire service to where it's bringing value. But particularly what you're talking about now is the difference where we're looking at old cities that are retrofitting or new cities that are developing overnight. And you mentioned these buildings looking at being considered as computers. But a lot of this ties back to how can this bring value to the first responder and firefighters and allow them to do their jobs better, safer, more efficiently. So how can first responders be part of this discussion, or what do first responders need to be aware of with this whole quote-unquote notion of smart buildings and smart cities as these buildings are becoming computers and as these buildings are now being integrated into the city? What do first responders need to be aware of, and how can they get more involved with this whole discussion as this is starting to become more mainstream?
Right, and I think that that's where the collisions of being able to get down to not, you know, throwing up another, you know, Internet of Things device. There's a lot of those, but those are Band-Aids. What it gets down to is how do you design and better by integrating the technology so that it's transparent to the process. What I mean by that is one thing we've learned is that, you know, we're seeing a lot of interesting pioneering implementations of, you know, Google Glass from 6-7 years ago, where, you know, great idea, but, you know, they forgot one little thing, that when you're inside of an event, you know, the materials of Google Glass would melt on your face. I mean, nice attempt, but, you know, come on. You know, there's got to be a more mature way and a discipline about how the fire service community can start to have that conversation. And I think the first step would always be a reach out to not only the design community, but also the technology community, where, you know, we have been introduced to some remarkable pieces of technology that, when you pull them together as a ecosystem, can solve some real world issues, such as how about the incident command report, where you go out to an event, and you have two primary ways of starting to, you know, manage the site, right? One is, you know, it's a clipboard and a pencil with a piece of paper, you know, your incident command report. That's good, right? And you're doing time and date stamps of when people go into the event, and hopefully you're capturing when they're coming out so that you understand the allocation of those resources. We're finding from 6 years ago when we first implemented our technology in Kansas City for a program called Orbi Fire. Orbi is a data-based system that we designed, which is named after the Latin word for world. And what we do is we hang different types of apps off of that captured data. The data can be in many different forms. In the case of Kansas City, we followed Google out with their gig fiber network, where Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri were the first, you know, twin city to receive the Google Fiber network. And the difference between what Google was doing and everyone else was that they were hooking up every home with the fiber network. But what they were also doing was taking very strategic placements of their Wi-Fi system publicly that would emanate out of the streetlights in and around Kansas City. So we saw that as an opportunity to work with the fire department and say, well, wait a second. You know, one of the problems is that you have a manual way of either using a clipboard or using a grease pencil up on the side of your apparatus to manage your people, right? And we fully got into, you know, well, how could we transparently make that happen? Again, transparent to the process is the key. And what we figured out was that when an event is called in, let's say it's a single-family home, it's a kitchen fire, smoke-filled condition, and throw in extra things in there. There's a missing child, let's say. Right? What we needed to do was create a geofence around that property. And that meant that the 911 call that comes in needed to have access immediately to the local Wi-Fi system that then would create that geofence. It's almost like an invisible mesh net dome that goes over that particular house, right? And then the surrounding property. What we figured out then was that through RFID, we could actually create these patches with the firefighters' names that go right on to the, you know, where the firefighter names are now on jackets and things like that. So as the firefighter enters that geofence, it automatically populates through the RFID tag a digital incident command report, like let's say like on a tablet, like an iPad. Right now, that time and date stamp is really, really important because, okay, these people went into it, but more importantly, a place like Kansas City that can have four seasons of weather in one day, or if it's day or night, you know, how do you respond to your partner and your brothers that are inside and you don't know if they're back out? The incident command report will be able to tell you that, because as the fire, as the firefighter comes out of that geofence, it automatically populates when they came out with the time and date stamp. Just this simple use of technology in a transparent way starts the process of managing not just the data, but the data that represents people, so that you're helping saving firefighter lives.
I love it.
That one piece was so profound to us that we said, well, we need to even do better. So there's technologies out of Israel, there's technologies out of Canada that we're now looking at that have been used to account for the number of people that count, you know, how many people are in a commercial office building, and we're transposing that into other forms of buildings. Meaning that when you walk in, it will know, it may not know if you're male or female, but it will know the number of people on every floor at that moment in time. And it can do everything from heat sensing all the way through, individuals that we know are sitting at a certain desk. So, you know, places like WeWork and these hot desk type of opportunities where you don't have the old days where people are actually in that senior vice president's office all the time, right? It's more of an open plan, which is what this whole shared workspace thing is about. And that's the majority of commercial space today. What happens when there's a fire event that breaks out? It used to be, well, we know that, you know, Joe in the corner office is always there. Well, you can't count on that now, because with the shared space, people can be all over the place because they literally sit down together as a work team where the space is available. So this actually now, again, provides firefighters with data so that before they're getting to the site and then having to do an assessment, they're getting accurate data that's quantitative and qualitative even before they get there.
And Paul, to expand on that,
this is something that we're taking to heart, especially at a citywide scale with these smart cities, is we can provide a lot of data like that. But the problem is, how do we filter that down into something very simple so that a firefighter gets enough information, but then relies on their own instinct and their experience to actually think things through? Right. So one thing that we were warned is all this stuff is great, but what we don't want is an entire generation of firefighters looking at their iPhones and not really paying attention to what's happening out there. Right.
Yeah.
It's one of those chicken and egg things about, you know, how much information is too much, and then how do you make it valuable at that moment in time?
You answered my question.
Because 5 minutes later, that same data may not be as valuable.
You answered my question before
even. You know, it's we're taking a lot of our direction from knowledge management systems over the past 15, 20 years that have been employed by some of the largest companies in the world, where they needed to learn how to get a very specific piece of information, like an analytic, to a worker, in this case a firefighter, at that moment in time when it was necessary. And over time, when you start to collect that type of data, we're actually seeing the actual operations piece of that is still kind of clumsy. Like I said, we're learning about what data is important, what's the story we're telling, and how does that help a firefighter in so many different circumstances, be it, you know, a building collapse, be it a building fire, be it, you know, what's happening out in California, it seems, every other month with the wildfires. There's different types of data that's going to be necessary for those firefighters. But working with people like Captain Kirk McKenzie of the Consumers Fire Department in California, and Tom Calvert in Menlo Park, California, and these folks, what they're figuring out is that the information that you're getting from those specific events, when you start to categorize them and catalog them in a taxonomy, you're building a best practice and lessons learned way of education and training like we've never had before, because it's cost effective, it's real, and you can start to build programs around weaknesses depending, or strengths actually, depending on what type of firefighting is necessary for your part of the planet Earth. That is really exciting, because now we can start to take this information and use analytics and other types of tools that are not necessarily built for the firefighting community, But what we're doing is we're customizing it to make it that so that information is valuable. Well, you know, another piece of this that actually gets me up in the morning is the preventative side of things, not just from the design side, but also from the practicalities that, you know, mistakes happen, we're human, and fires happen. And I always loved, you know, especially here in the U.S., when, you know, when you're in elementary school and at least twice a year, you'd have, you know, the firefighters from the local community coming in. And it's to say hello and all that great public service announcement type of stuff, you know, learning from a very young age about, you know, if fire happens and what happens if it catches you, you know, to drop, tuck, and roll. I mean, you know, all kids can recite all of that. But what's interesting is, you know, I have a son that's now in second grade, and he's still receiving things after the firefighters leave, like things, you know, like promotional stickers or the magnets that go up on your refrigerator. What's nice is they are pushing things like, you know, if there's a fire, find a safe place where the entire family can meet, so, you know, everyone knows everyone's out safe. All that stuff is great. But some of the leave behinds are also, they're still okay, but, you know, the kids are using things like Fortnite and Roblox and Minecraft nowadays, and they're getting a coloring book. And you're going, well, you know, the information that we're capturing about, again, best practices and preventive ways of working, wouldn't it be really interesting if we take the same technologies that we're using for, like, let's say, Orbi Fire, for managing how you get that geofenced information into, you know, into a tablet to fill out a form? Well, we're actually using a 3D component for that, so that, again, you can watch the avatars move, you know, the dots, you know, on the floor plan that are now in 3D, to actually see how the firefighters operated and moved so that they can learn from it. And that's all based on a gaming engine. So one of the ideas about PSAs is, you know, who's going to be the first person to step up and say, listen, we have a lot of real good information here that is real life that can be put into a story about preventive, you know, preventive ways, or if something does happen, what to do, and make it a game, you know, so that the leave behind is a link or it's an app that these kids can use. And just because it's education is entertainment, they're learning. And it just becomes part of instinct about how that can happen for a community. So we're seeing, you know, the soft side of things on the software for PSAs and education learning. We're seeing the hardware things of being able to capture a lot of this information, of the amount of people that are in a space so that it can be communicated to, you know, understanding the movements of, you know, of your fellow firefighters and being able then to help people in distress and or understand that you at least know where people are. That this is the pioneering cow paths that we're in right now. What I'm really looking forward to is more interaction and more communication with communities like what you're building here, Kevin, right? Because those conversations become very valuable because it's not just, you know, us thinking up some cool stuff. It's where's the practicality of that? And, you know, where is it where the rubber meets the road? So that we have a roadmap that is aspirational, but that we have very pragmatic steps about how we can start to implement this. Mm-hmm. You know, our friends over at Quake Technologies, you know, Sam Cossum and those, you know, the very talented group of folks are doing some amazing stuff with, you know, visors and being able to see through smoke and all sorts of really, really interesting stuff. I tie that back together with, you know, our friends over at Point Grab that are, you know, taking into account where people are within a building in real time. You put those two things together with a management platform like what we have, and suddenly the world starts to open up. You know, take a look at what, you know, Captain Caliburn is doing over in Menlo Park and the other firefighters in California, the drones. You know, all of this stuff right now is pioneering. As we start to move forward, I'm hoping that the community that you're building starts to understand that this is not just an exercise in disrupting something. It's about, number one, you know, leverage the technology that a lot of people put a lot of time and money into and see how we can customize it for you. And if you have that conversation, we can actually move forward. This isn't about making money. It's about saving lives.
I love it. And really a wealth of knowledge. And I'm sorry for kind of interrupting you there, but you pretty much answered my question as you were going into it. And one of the big things I've seen in the data realm is we're now almost inundated with too much data, and sometimes it's hard to really know what to do with it, especially in a real-time situation where you have a firefighter where even if he's the smartest person in the world, he can only take in so much data and do so much. So what I'd like to have you dive in a little more, though, is how do we combat that issue of data overload? And you mentioned some type of analytics, but how can we integrate different levels of whether it's artificial intelligence or some type of algorithm analytics that allows us to interpret this data? And I see you're using the whole information communications tech and Orbi with kind of these different layers of info and data to be able to understand and interpret all this within the management software. But how is that, and why is that so important for first responders? Because, again, we can sit here and look at a whiteboard and talk about this till we're blue in the face, but if it doesn't help the first responder, it's really not doing any good.
And that's the bottom line, isn't it? There's a lot of people in the tech industry that build things with one use case or at least a group of use cases that they think that they're solving one problem, yet you have another organization or another community of folks say, wow, that's really interesting, but we could use it this way. And that's always the wonderment of, you know, working with software developers, where they develop something thinking the outputs are going to be one thing, yet its most valuable thing is something they haven't even thought of because the users take it onto themselves, right? And this is where that conversation, Kevin, has to happen, right? We as real estate developers that rely on the fire service community to communicate with us, there's got to be mechanisms in place that are formal, maybe informal, pick up the phone, send a text, that type of thing, in order to get those needs out. And then after we build something, you know, the beautiful thing about, you know, working with tech is we can change quicker than something that is physically in place. It's difficult to rework a building, right? Or a piece of infrastructure. It's relatively simple to go back in and change certain processes about what information I need. So here's a case in point. This past Christmas was an amazing year for a lot of families because, we're in a good economy. And when you take a look at groups, even like Amazon, I mean, all of their records were blown. And one of the biggest purchases was on this idea of voice assistants. Google Assistant being one of them, Alexa in the form of Amazon's Echo Dots and Echoes as another, right? And what we're finding, I know personally, is that, well, hang on a second, there goes Alexa talking because I mentioned her name, right? Huh. It becomes part, I thought it was spooky. Like, I don't want ears always listening to what I have to say. But because you have a trigger, by saying, Alexa, stop, right? Things like that. It becomes a really interesting way of how it becomes part of your processes. In other words, if I want to hear music now, I don't go to Amazon Prime or go to, iTunes. I just talk to Alexa and she plays it and it's on a really nice sound system and wow, cool, or if I wonder what time it is, I don't have to look at the clock, I ask her, or if I want to get some more information, I'm finding uses for this thing that are just remarkable. And a lot of it has to do with pattern behavior and the way that you are now taking an inanimate object and actually making it part of your family, almost like a pet in a strange way, like an oracle, this knowing all thing that you communicate with. It'll be interesting to see how this goes through the next iteration into life safety management, that type of thing, and how, I can see things like Microsoft Windows in the future being all voice activated, right? Because, the typing thing is something you have to learn. Now we're typing with like millimeters of our thumbs on things like iPhones, which is ridiculous. What's that next step? And what we're looking at is this idea of pattern recognition, the idea of machine learning, that the machine learns based on those patterns, what becomes important and what not. So it has its own built-in filter because Alexa's learning on a personal basis, a lot of how I talk, my accent, that type of thing. And it starts to learn and filter what's important and what's not and what may be interesting to me. I'm taking that same type of approach with the data that we're capturing from the firefighting community. Now, this is where things get interesting because in the design and construction industry, because we're such a large industry, you know, just figure everything that's being constructed around the world, you know, we're a little under $7.8 trillion annually of expense. So that's a lot of, it's a big, it's a big ship. And what we're, how we communicate is based upon a data taxonomy that was based upon paper. So this was pre-computers, pre-digitization, that we had to categorize big buckets of information just so that, you know, the local lumberyard, like your Home Depot or your Lowe's, can talk with an architect or talk with a subcontractor or a contractor or the owner. And we're all talking in the same language, at least, right? And that taxonomy is called master format. We've divided things into 16 big divisions that anyone inside of our industry knows that division 8 is doors and windows, division 9 is finishes, division 3 is concrete. It's just a known thing. It's how we communicate, right? That has to happen for the firefighting community in order for any of this knowledge management, this idea of machine learning and what some people are calling, this idea of artificial intelligence. It's not quite AI, by the way. It's really just pattern behavior and learning, machine learning. We'll get to how, from Space Odyssey and all that stuff in the future. But for right now, that's marketing people saying that it's AI. But mm-hmm. It really is about seeing those patterns and understanding how to filter what's important and what's not. I think that that is, again, a pioneering place where we need to have a lot of really interesting conversations that can start with these types of podcasts and hopefully face-to-face meetings at places like, an event like FDIC in Indianapolis this April. Those are the types of opportunities for us to collaborate, because there is no competition in this. This is about trying to move the needle forward. And what we're finding with that needle moving forward is that we have a lot to learn from others that not necessarily have anything or have even a relationship in back with the with the fire service community. But I think, and I have the hope that, through mechanisms like these podcasts and people like yourself that are carrying the torch up here saying, hey, this is a new generation, this is a new way of how we can learn and actually save lives. I think that right now would be, this idea of filtering data and understand, is there a taxonomy that we can put together so that when the machines and things, quote unquote, in the cloud start to gather a lot of this information from multiple sources and multiple solution providers, that we at least have a bucket so that the machine understands when it's feeding information back out to a firefighter during an incident, that it is the best quality information that person can get in the format that person wants. So again, I think, partnering up with an Amazon to come into the firefighting community and say, hey, we figured out how to capture a multitude of pieces of information of people's lifestyles inside their homes and be able to improve that. Is there something there that we could partner up with an Amazon to say, well, why don't we use the same technology, but actually show them the data that we're capturing and saying, can you help? So again, I'm finding that when we go out to communities that are not, traditionally related back into the firefighting community, that we open arms everywhere we go going, yeah, I want to be part of that. So again, it's a little bit of a call to arms, but don't be afraid about picking up the phone and saying, hey, Jeff Bezos, we need some help.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned earlier Fortnite and some of these other gaming cultures, and whether it's gaming or the tech industry or some other industry, where I think what we're seeing is there's a lot of existing technology and capabilities out there in various concurrent industries that can be very applicable for value-added use cases in the fire service. And it's a matter of connecting those dots, and if anything, just really having that discussion. And part of it's podcasting, part of it's in-person events, but I think the most important thing is collaboration. And you mentioned that there's no competition here. We're all on the same team. The safety of people inside buildings, the safety of first responders, we all want the same thing. We all want to be happy. We all want to go back home at night to our families. And so how do we work across industries and work together to pull all this together? Because there's a lot of moving pieces, and this isn't going to happen overnight. But you're right, there is a new generation, there is a new wave, and it's sort of at a point now where we can't sit and just say, hey, the status quo of what's happened the last 100 years is okay, because some of these deaths that are happening are unacceptable. And some of these, just the investment and the risk are too high now to where we can no longer ignore some of this technology adoption that is going to make our life that much better.
Well said.
Yeah, thank you. So just kind of a final question, and maybe you can or cannot answer this. You being such a kind of a smart city guy and talking a lot about buildings, I'm interested. Do you have a, maybe you can say it or not, but do you have a favorite building or a favorite city? And you can have more than one answer.
Oh, wow. Yeah. City-wise, I'm infatuated with cities that just are so unique that they're like nowhere else in the world. A place like New Orleans. I mean, think of the food, think of the culture, think of the layout of the city. There's nothing like it in the world. I went for my first time in my life, and I've been just about everywhere. According to like one of those Google Earth things, I've been to 62% of it.
Wow.
Right? Which is, I travel too much. But my first time ever was to go to Venice this past October. What an experience. You know, I literally felt transformed, you know, walking through that unbelievable environment. I mean, you know, there's no way you're going to get a pump truck down any of those streets, right? Just like, how do they do firefighting, right? Yet that place has existed for centuries, right? And then, you know, when I take a look at the newer cities, Seoul has a soulfulness about it that is not, you know, it's a modern city, but it's not Dubai, right? Where Dubai now is backtracking into being the Las Vegas of the new Middle East, to being something that does have a contextualization about it, that hopefully will start to build a soul around very soulless buildings, right? And I think that's, you know, where architectural firms like BIG, the Bjarke Ingels Group out of Copenhagen in New York, they are taking such a radical approach to what buildings mean, not just for the person that's paying for it and the people that live, work, play, and learn in them, but how does it affect the community surrounding it? You know, what is it trying to say? You know, and what's its function? Calatrava, wonderful Spanish engineer architect, that put up the new transportation hub down by Ground Zero, is very poetic, and it has such an inspirational approach that some of the functions will bring you to tears. One of those would be that in respect for the firefighters, the police, and the workers down at Grand Zero that lost their lives, every year the actual roof of this beautiful rotunda where you can either go to buses, you know, switch subway lines, get out to the street, that particular rotunda then has this it's roof that opens up, right? And it only opens up at the time of when the two Twin Towers collapsed on September 11th. And what it's meant to symbolize is that it's letting the souls of the dead rise to heaven. And then it closes up for the rest of the year. Those simple things are so powerful that resonate within individuals and entire communities. That, you know, I hope aspirationally that, you know, my fellow architects start to rethink what they do. You know, we have a social responsibility, we have a financial responsibility, we have a sustainable, environmental, responsibility that should just be called good design. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of people that put, the cape on and say, oh, it's all about green and, sustainable. And, I'm the farthest person that, hugs on trees and wears Birkenstocks. That's not me. But I was always brought up that that's just good design. And good design can solve a lot of problems. Good design doesn't cost more money. If anything, it can save you money. And in the case of firefighting, I think save lives.
Mm-hmm. I love it. And yeah, I think you make a good point where it's not about building the fastest, building the biggest, building the greenest building or structure, but it's really about the best context and best design for that particular city. And every city has such a unique culture and character. And it's funny you say that. New Orleans is actually my favorite city, and as is Venice. I think one of the cool things about both those cities is their relationship with water. A lot of big cities all have some dependence on water, but particularly those cities are fighting the rise of the oceans and various aspects of climate change. So it is very interesting to look how they're dealing with the rise of the oceans and interaction with natural disasters, and obviously how they deal with fire. So many factors to go into the consideration, and I know we could keep this conversation going on for hours, and but we're right around 40 minutes here, and but I really, really appreciate your time today. If people wanted to learn more about you or the Digit Group or get in touch, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Definitely check out our website, which is thedigitgroup.com. And also, just especially in the firefighting community, the FDIC I attend, I'll be the keynote speaker on the main stage this year. Thank you, Captain Bobby Halton, for that, honor and rare opportunity to allow a non, professional fire service member share some perspective. And I think that the humbleness that is authentic about what I feel for the community that's listening now, is that you really are, our heroes. And I don't think that's overstating anything. I think it's not said enough, that, I get up every day and I have the responsibility to create urban futures. And it's a great job. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I have to anticipate needs that don't exist right now. And that is a challenge, because when you're changing the world for good, you're also faced with a lot of bad, right? And that's really cool. But what this community does, every day they get up, and I think you mentioned it before, there's no guarantee that they're coming home. Wow. I mean, that selflessness, is something that needs to be celebrated. And the more that we can have different industries that are doing some remarkable things, everything from the entertainment industry, our work right now with the special effects and visualization groups that are creating movies like the Marvel Comics universe, we are in partnership with two of those major shops. They just got completed with Infinity Wars with Avengers, and now they're looking at the fire, solutions that we're looking at for photorealism, or being able to put haptic technologies together for training and education and things like that. I mean, I would never have thought in a million years that the world of Hollywood would pay attention to the firefighting community, and here we are. So don't be afraid. There are no rules right now. I think we do need to be shoulder to shoulder on a lot of this, because again, it's not just about making the money. There's plenty of that in the pie. It's about, how do we start to position this thing in a unique way so that, number one, we get the younger generations looking at the community as a coolness factor. I'm just waiting for the right moment for, my son to be playing, a firefighter-centric, version of Fortnite. I mean, he's really good at the other stuff, and I'm sure he'd dive right into it. So would his friends. So, there's that great relationship right now, that has been part of all communities, the physical communities with their firefighting heroes. I think it needs to be celebrated more, and I think that with more wins of showing how the technology becomes transparent to the process, how it has some meaningful results, I think we have a bright future.
I agree, and well said. Thank you, Paul, so much for your time, and I look forward to talking with you more soon.
Thanks, Ken.
Recap this episode, I found it really fascinating how Paul was diving into the context of the building for the culture, for the city, and the people that are occupying it. Sometimes on design within a new city as it's rapidly developing, whether it's a ghost city in China or some of these Middle East areas are developing really quickly, we can develop and design these buildings, but if they don't really fit the culture, then it's just kind of soulless. And so sometimes we need to look at more than just, hey, let's build something just that meets a minimum code, but let's go above and beyond and really understand what the community wants and how it can be the best building for that community. I really liked this whole discussion around practicality in terms of there's so many different data sets out there and different sensors within buildings, and we're almost the whole discussion of data overload, but we really need to make sure we're taking all these different data sets and practically integrating it to how this can go into an interface to help first responders respond to fires before, during, and after. So I really like that discussion. His mention of how artificial intelligence is sometimes a little bit overblown, and I was thinking about that. Well, he really talked about it's really more pattern behavior and pattern recognition. So I think there is definitely a little discussion about what is artificial intelligence and what is pattern behavior and recognition, and what does that all mean? I also thought it was really interesting to look at some of the challenges between how are we designing New Orleans and Chicago into a new city landscape versus how are we looking at some of these suburban areas in the Middle East that are just popping up out of nowhere. And it's definitely now kind of gives us some context on, well, what else can we do to make buildings smart? We can add all different types of sensors to it, but then again, it's what data are we collecting from it, and then how are we going to do something with that data? And the last point that continues to resonate with me, and obviously we all know Amazon Alexa, is such a behemoth in the space, and how can we use voice assistants and voice data as a very important data set to help us better understand who's in the building, where are they even in the building, how are people living their lifestyle in that building. Obviously, now we're getting into the whole discussion of privacy and is that data public or not, and that's a whole nother can of worms. But the whole voice assistant in Amazon is super interesting and something we really need to dive into more. If you got any further questions or any ideas, reach out to me directly. We want to continue to make content and dive into some of these topics for you guys. So hit me up, Kevin Sofen at darley.com, KevinSofen at darley.com, or hit us up at Twitter or Facebook or Instagram at Smart Firefighting. Thanks for listening. I hope you guys have a great day.